You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm Mike O'Hanlon, and we're thrilled today to welcome Dr. Victoria Panova from Moscow. And I'm up here with my colleagues, Jeremy Shapiro and Steve Pfeiffer as well. We'd like to discuss the crisis in U.S.-Russia relations and the path forward, as well as the origins of this crisis, which presumably are important to understand for how to go forward and how to mitigate and hopefully resolve the terrible challenges to our relationship that we've seen in 2014. I just want to say a couple of words of background about what we're hoping to achieve with the conversation up here. We'll go to you about halfway through for your questions. But we'll begin with a couple of questions from me, starting with Victoria and then going to Jeremy and Steve. And the idea here, let me just explain a little bit about the genesis of this event. Our thinking was that sometimes U.S.-Russian dialogues feel like a conversation between people on both sides who have been around quite a while, and sometimes some of the arguments seem familiar and sometimes even tired, and obviously we're mired in a bit of an impasse that we maybe need some fresh thinking to get beyond. So I think you can all see that I've got a youthful panel, but especially my friend Victoria from Russia, who is clearly not a holdover from the Brezhnev regime and is not here to speak on behalf of the Russian state. But when she and I were on a panel together in China 2 months ago, I also saw that there was a great deal of eloquence in her ability to be a Russian patriot. And I'll let her define her own views further for you. But it was clearly a way of helping me understand why, not so much why Vladimir Putin does what he does, but why 85% of Russians right now think he's doing an okay job. Not that she's going to defend everything he does necessarily. Again, I'll leave that to her. But the idea here is there's something going on in Russia that's a lot bigger than one person, and that we Americans probably can benefit from getting a little greater understanding of. And because she's trained in international relations, she has a PhD, from the same university where she now teaches in Moscow, MGIMO University, associated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, because she also has studied in the United States, spent 2 years here in high school in Chicago. She understands a bit about both countries and certainly has her own independent views on Russia, but I hope is able to help us understand a bit better what's going on in terms of Russian politics today. But, of course, this is about the bilateral relationship, and so I think it's very helpful, of course, to have two Americans as well, and I have two of my favorite colleagues with particularly germane insights on this question. Steve Pfeiffer was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, as I think most of you know by now, about 15 years ago, and has also worked a great deal during his career in the U.S. Foreign Service, but also in his time at Brookings on U.S.-Russia relations. So he has been pro-Ukraine and pro-U.S.-Russia relations, and has a number of perspectives that I think can be very helpful in this conversation as well. In recent months, I think he's been pushing back fairly firmly against President Putin in his recommendations in terms of policy. So there's obviously a bit of an impasse in the relationship that he sees, but it's out of a background in trying to foster better U.S.-Russian relations through the arms control domain and other aspects of the diplomatic relationship. And so I think we have the basis here for a lot of people coming at this question with a desire to make the relationship work, but obviously different backgrounds and perspectives. Jeremy Shapiro was in the Obama administration and wrestled with some of the very acute issues that have been so divisive in the relationship. Not so much Ukraine per se, as I understand it, because he was there primarily in the first term and was working largely on the Syria portfolio and other issues where the United States and Russia were at loggerheads. And Jeremy's job was to try to figure out how to solve the problem and how to do so in a way that elicited maximum cooperation from other countries. And so, therefore, he was thinking hard about this relationship as well. So that's the theory behind the event. We're very glad to have you here. What I'd like to do now, and I'm just going to give you a little bit of the roadmap and then launch right into it. In the first question I'm going to ask, starting with Victoria, is, are there still any good aspects to the U.S.-Russia relationship? Because we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about differences and trying to understand the differences and hopefully building some bridges, but I'm sure also uncovering where we do strongly disagree And before we get to that point, I'm hoping that these three panelists can reassure me that we're not really on the verge of another Cold War. But I'll let them tell me the answer to that question in just a second. So are there still any areas of ongoing important U.S.-Russia cooperation and collaboration? And then secondly, I want to understand, as I would assume you do too, from their point of view, the origins of the current crisis in relations. And I don't think the term crisis is too strong. I think it's a severe and very serious crisis in U.S.-Russia relations that continues even to this day, even if the Ebola crisis and the ISIS crisis are slightly higher on our radar screen this particular week in Washington, not to mention a Redskins victory. Who would have thought that was even possible anymore? But given that we're at a point where we've been in a little bit of a quieter moment, I think it's important not to lose sight of the unresolved issues, not only in Ukraine but beyond. So what was the origin of the current set of problems? And then finally, obviously, the path forward. How do we solve these problems or at least prevent them from erupting into a major crisis? Depending on the timing, I may defer on that question and hope that some of your questions will get at that. But in any event, we'll play that part by ear. So let me now begin. Again, Victoria, thank you very much for being here. And would like to welcome you to Brookings, welcome you to D.C. At least we've produced some good fall weather and I hope some good conversation. If I could just ask you to talk about where you still see, if anywhere, some ongoing grounds for U.S.-Russia cooperation.
Thank you, Mike. Mike, great pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming. Well, first of all, just to pick up on what you said, you might be not considering Russia as the biggest threat, but your president, when he was talking at the United Nations, he put it above ISIS. Obviously, so Russia comes right after Ebola, so I hope we do not mix, which was taken very with lots of clear not understanding from the part on the part of population especially. So, but well, that's his view, and I really hope this is not something that all of you are having here. Besides, I mean, if you look at me, I'm sure you would see that there's nothing to be afraid of. So.
And
but another thing is I think it's important to concentrate not as much on the, I mean, on this as well, I will talk about it as well, but not just on the bilateral relations, but what we do have to understand is that both of our countries have a special, very special role and very special responsibility in terms of global governance and ensuring their stability of the global order. So this is extremely important, and that's why what we have to, I mean, of course, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, our politicians were still very eager to see Russia as a still superpower, which was not the case. And for many years, Americans were discarding it as a country of importance, regional power at most, even not that much. But the matter is not about Russia having nukes still. It's about, and I'm sure Stephen will have a lot to say about that. It's more about that Russia is a long-term player in the global politics. It knows how to deal with it, and we do have this special responsibility. And the problem that comes here does not lay in the foundation of issue-specific projects that we are cooperating or opposing each other with. It lies in the area of having different images of the world. We see, unfortunately, very differently of what is good for the world and what is not good for the world. And what are the proper arrangements? Russians, and it's a long-term political tradition, make an emphasis on the democratic world order, which is not necessarily democracy of the internal structure. We do have differences in here, yeah, as well. But it's a pushing the idea that it's a UN charter that comes at the basis. It's not only democratic regimes that can be at the core of this deciding and making the rules, but it should be everybody and everybody having the right to say. while America and a number of its allies will claim a priority right for deciding on how the world should function for democracies. So this is a very deep difference. So this is one thing. Another one is that it's a very alarming tendency, and unfortunately here we are not in the same boat, at least at the moment. It's an ongoing and growing polarization of the world that we're seeing, and it's not just Russia against the West. If you look at the current situation, it's the West against a lot of other, not centers of power, but poles in the world. China is on the like somewhere else now, but it will be growing and coming with the assertive foreign policy, and it will be even more different from how you see the world as opposed to how Russians see the world. So I would claim, as Mike rightly said, I've spent quite some time here and have a lot of American friends. We are very much alike. We're not different. We don't have different psychology. We don't have different mentality. Maybe a few little different things, minor ones, but in general, we are very much alike. This is not the case with civilizations that are very much in a different pole. And the reason for further polarization lies in the inability of the main poles to want to understand each other and to want to adapt to each other. And I don't mean here only America, of course, because I've been, I think a year ago, it was a conference on Asia-Pacific security, primarily marine security, and the Chinese scholars and high-level officials were saying quite eloquently that, you know, guys, 100 years of humiliation you had, no longer. We are coming up. We are changing the rules. Those will be new. For now, in Asia Pacific, you will have to abide by those. So there should be, which I don't see at the moment, unfortunately, a growing closer, but now we are growing apart. Another alarming tendency is growing militarization. And when we have this higher military power, which is more dominant over rule of law, that leads us to a more black and white picture, right? So we don't see any aspects of gray and color. We see only black and white. And in this mode, our governments, unfortunately, start functioning from crisis to crisis. So it doesn't have an idea of the world developing stably and peacefully. So it does involve necessity of having this crisis. On the one hand, this crisis mode gives some room for maneuver and considerable room for cooperation between Russia and America. But what we see now, unfortunately, that this cooperative model is more pushed to the side. So yes, we have still Afghanistan, and I would like to tell you right away the reason why I would say Russia is willing to have a compromise is that it never imposed any counter sanctions, as they put it, in the area which is very vital for United States or for Western colleagues. There is nothing introduced in terms of northern distribution network. It continues. There is nothing. So this is an area where we have a common goal. Instability in regions from Libya to Afghanistan, in Syria, in parts of Africa, terrorism, drugs. With drugs, I would say we do have differences, but it's a short-term, like an immediate difference on the mandate of what we want to do, what we have to do. It can involve some commercial interests. But in general, none of our countries are interested in having our populations suffer from that. So all those main global threats are indicative of the necessity for us to continue cooperating. And, okay, NDN is where we continue space exploration. It was not... I heard a couple of experts, not a couple, many experts talking, okay, let's just cut all the space, peaceful space exploration activities. And we know here that it's a mutual dependence, but in this case it's probably more of dependence of American side on Russia. This was not stopped. So this is clearly a signal that in important areas where we have common attitudes, Russia is willing to continue. If we talk, I'm quite sure my colleagues will talk about Putin or Russian authorities not willing to continue disarmament negotiations. But this is also not about Russian-American discords. It's rather about Russia saying, okay, first we involve everybody, and then we can continue discussing the issue. So it's just not enough any longer to continue the disarmament with the just two countries involved, even if, yes, true, we have the biggest amount. But we want all, well, not five, now more, all nine official and non-official nuclear club members in the game. So I would say, unfortunately, we're witnessing very irrational process now, which is counter to all of our interests. Russia is probably more vulnerable, I would agree with that. But I'm quite sure that the situation of not understanding common areas would lead to trouble not only in Russia, but in here, in Europe, and in other parts of the world.
That's a great opening. Thank you. One follow-up quickly before I go to Steve and then Jeremy. If you had to put all this together, you talked about the problems, and we'll come back to those. You talked about the areas of cooperation, Afghanistan, counter-narcotics, cooperation in space. You didn't even mention Iran and North Korea because you were being kind to me and getting a brief opening out there, but I'm sure you could have added that. And so there are a number of areas. But if you add up all the positives and you contrast them with the negatives, and you have to do sort of a bottom line, and you compare where we are today to where we were in the Cold War, how far have we slipped back towards the Cold War? Are we sort of halfway back? I'm just curious. Are we almost that far back? Or for all the bad things of 2014, do you still see this relationship as fundamentally much more cooperative today than it was 25, 30, 35 years ago?
I would say we might be in a more dangerous situation than we had during the Cold War, because Russian government still sees itself and the country as a legitimate global player. And in here, it is seen that there is probably Russia is not given the right to see itself as a global player.
Interesting.
And I would see the sanctions introduced when we start. We will get to it later, right? But it's the first time, I don't think during the Cold War, that we had any targeting of officials, of Soviet officials, with the sanctions of the United States at that point. Now we're seeing this, and this is a clearly, and it seemed like that from the Russian side, meddling with internal affairs of the country, which in the Russian view, and probably in everybody's view, lowers its sovereign status. And sovereignty is very important for the country.
Great, great. Okay, Steve, over to you. I'd love to get your thoughts on where we're still cooperating.
Okay, well, let me first say I don't think we're yet in the Cold War. And although Mike kindly put me in with the rest of the spring chickens up here, I was on the NATO desk, for example, in 1983 after the downing of the Korean airliner, where we really, I think, were in a very intense period. So I would certainly say that U.S.-Russia relations are now at their lowest point since 1991. But I don't think the way we're lined up against each other yet qualifies for the Cold War. And I would agree with Victoria's points on there are, I think, important areas where it makes sense for the United States and Russia to cooperate. Counterterrorism, which apparently was the focus of the conversation between Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov last week. I would put Iran down there where I think there is cooperation in the P5+1. Afghanistan, although I think here again, it's not, I think that the sides are cooperating because they want to be helpful. I think the sides are motivated by their own interests. And you may have a different, I think in the case of Afghanistan, from Russia's point of view, You know, there's a reason not to see America fail in Afghanistan, because if there's a failure, if the Taliban comes back, it's a problem for us, but it's going to be a problem 6,000 miles closer to Russia. On the arms control side, I think the sides clearly have an interest in going forward with the strategic arms, the new strategic arms reduction treaty. And I would actually agree with you in principle. At some point, you have to bring others in. But I would say at this point, where I think the United States and Russia each have about 4,500 total nuclear warheads, and the next country would be France at maybe 300, there's probably still some more room for the U.S. and Russia to do things bilaterally. On the President Obama speech in New York, I regret the ordering of that, because I don't think that the administration truly sees Russia as the number one threat after Ebola.
Number two.
Not even number two. I mean, I think in strategic terms, they see other big problems out there. And Russia is kind of, it's a crisis now because what's happened in Ukraine over the last 8 months. But I don't get the sense anybody in the administration really welcomes this crisis. You know, they would like to see it just go away. But they feel that the way things have developed, that there has to be an American response. But again, I regret the fact that the ordering of that made it seem in Russia like President Obama was putting Russia higher on the threat list than I think actually the White House would do. And then finally, I would agree. I mean, I think there are just very different perceptions between Washington and Moscow about things like global order, about how each is acting, that probably fuel and make more difficult some of the problems that we have. And one of the challenges I think that both sides have, and I think it's harder here in part because of the political environment, is pursuing a balanced policy where on the one hand you have an issue where, as Mike said, I've been fairly hawkish in terms of pushing back against Russia on Ukraine. But it's also, I think, important to continue to cooperate on these other areas where we have very important questions where American and Russian issues converge. And maintaining that kind of balance is sometimes not easy, particularly here where I think in the political environment, you may be challenged for advocating any cooperation with Russia when there are these problems in Ukraine. And that's going to be, I think, one of the challenges that the administration is going to have to deal with, is justifying why, despite all the concerns about what's going on between Russia and Ukraine, there still are reasons to cooperate on other issues with Russia where, in fact, our interests converge.
Jeremy, over to you.
Thanks. I find myself, as often after following Steve, in a situation where everything has been said, but not everything has been said by me. So I'll try to repeat it, but with a sort of more conceptual gloss so it appears original. I think that actually the sort of Cold War point question that you asked is a good entree, because I think that, as Steve said, we're not where we were in the Cold War. And I think it's to understand why U.S. and Russia are cooperating where they are and why they aren't, I think it's interesting to consider the differences. In the Cold War, we both viewed ourselves as in a global struggle that took place everywhere and anywhere, from Guatemala to Africa to Vietnam, all the way to the Central Front in Europe. Now, there is no global struggle, really, and I think both sides see it that way, but there is a regional struggle that takes place along the borders, roughly speaking, of Russia. And you see in the pattern of U.S.-Russian cooperation that they are able to cooperate on global issues, on issues that are outside of the region of Russia, on things like Afghanistan, on counterterrorism in the Middle East. But they have a much greater difficulty, and I would say since the Ukraine crisis, they've almost completely broken down cooperating on regional issues that take place near the borders of Russia. It's interesting to sort of look at this is not obviously a firm dividing line, and certain global issues, especially from Russia's perspective, reflect on the situation in the region and the situation in Russia. And on those issues, it's much harder to cooperate. And so you see that when even on a global issue that involves support for an insurgency or support for overthrowing a regime, that's not something that Russia is willing to cooperate with the United States on, generally speaking. But when it's a question of a transnational threat like counterterrorism or nuclear proliferation or fighting an insurgency like the Taliban, that is something that they can cooperate on. Now, critical to having this sort of dual method of cooperating globally and not cooperating regionally is the question of compartmentalization. And I think, again, here Steve said it, but not with as many fancy terms. It is a real challenge, I think, on both sides, frankly, to be able to focus on the things you can cooperate on and disagree about the things you disagree on and not let the two bleed into each other. Frankly, the Russians are somewhat better at this than we are because we have a much more contentious domestic politics. And as Steve said, black and white view of the world that Victoria alluded to that is you frequently hear in U.S. domestic politics makes it difficult to cooperate on some issues while you're fighting on others. One of the things that I noticed in the State Department is that Russia is quite good at compartmentalizing, almost scary good. And you'll notice in their responses to in struggles with the United States that they most frequently, almost always, respond what in a way that we used to call symmetrical, which is that they respond on the issue that we're struggling with, not, and they don't let it bleed into other issues. Victoria gave an example of this when she said that the Northern Distribution Network has not been affected by the very bitter confrontation over Ukraine that we've seen recently. When the United States published what we called the Magnitsky List, which was a pre-Ukraine human rights sanctions against Russia and against specific Russian officials, there was great worry in the U.S. government that it would affect things like cooperation over Iran, cooperation over the Northern Distribution Network. It didn't. The response was that the Russians published their own Magnitsky List, which nobody here even noticed because who really wants to vacation in Russia anyway? And so it was in some sense not a symmetrical response, but it was technically symmetrical. I think the U.S. has a lot more difficulty with this, as Steve said, and I think the real question going forward, because I think we're likely to continue to have a lot of confrontation on regional issues, is whether the U.S. particularly can maintain or can achieve this level of compartmentalization and whether the Russians can maintain it.
Thank you. What I'd like to do now, we're going to work from Steve down towards Victoria. This is by her request because my temptation was to always give her the floor first because we want to understand her perspective. But it's also, I can see why on this next question, in some ways it's more hospitable of us to begin with the Americans and then work towards the Russian perspective on this panel. Because now we're going to try to delve into the issue of how we got to where we are a little bit more. Going back as far historically in the modern era, in the post-Cold War era, as people feel they need to explain the main issues that have arisen, the main causes. And we're ultimately, in the conversation with you, going to look to the future and to how we build bridges, repair them, solve problems. But I think it's important to, even though we've already heard some of this discussion, to actually just ask the question directly, what are the most important causes of the crisis that we're in now? So, Steve, if I could begin with you, please, on that.
Well, maybe I'll go back and start with the reset. And I'd be maybe one of the few people who actually say the reset was a success. The mistake the administration made was that early 2011, they should have said, reset's done, and move on to something else. Because the reset originally was not designed to move U.S.-Russia relations to some kind of nirvana. The objective was to bring the relationship out of the very low point that you had in 2008 following the Russia-Georgia conflict and get it back to a point where you could actually begin to do some general business that would be in the interest of both sides. And I think if you look at what happened in 2009 and 2010, there were some fairly good accomplishments from the perspective of both. The New START Treaty, greater cooperation on Iran, greater cooperation on Afghanistan. Russia got into the WTO. Now, the problem that we had is once the relationship moved back in a more positive direction, and this was the same problem that the Clinton administration had in the mid-1990s and the Bush administration had in its second term, was it was then very difficult to sort of sustain that and build on it. So you then had this downward trend. I would go back and say I think it started with things like the inability of the sides to build on an agreement at the end of 2010 to develop a cooperative missile defense in Europe. And the longer that went without in fact realizing that, even though I think there were a lot of good ideas that both sides seemed to be talking about, we got to that point, and then missile defense moved from an area of potential cooperation to an area of disagreement. You had elections playing out in both countries. It started in the second half of 2011 in Russia. In the United States, you know, our election probably started, 2010. But elections are not good backdrops for U.S.-Russia relations. I think from our perspective, you saw in Russia some elements of anti-Americanism being used in the campaign. And certainly here, I think as a general rule, unless you're Israel, you don't ever want to be mentioned in an American presidential campaign because it's not going to be positive. So that didn't help. You had then differences emerge over things like Libya, particularly over Syria, where you had just contrasting viewpoints. The Magnitsky bill, I think, was a difficult issue. There was, I think, some brief hope in the administration that after the elections, early 2013, they could move back towards a more positive mode. But never really got any traction on that to the point where in summer of 2013, they concluded that they postponed canceled the summit that was planned for Moscow in September. And the rationale, I think the press focused on the Snowden question, which I think was a mistake. The real issue when you talk to people in the administration was they said on the big issues that they were looking to, on arms control, missile defense cooperation, economic relations, they just didn't see any progress that would merit a summit-level meeting. So I think the relationship was in a more difficult situation well before the Ukraine crisis broke out. But once the Ukraine crisis broke out, and particularly when it morphed from an internal Ukrainian dispute to a Ukraine-Russia issue, then it really, I think, took the relationship down to a more difficult level.
You know, that's great. And I want to follow up with one more question before I go to Jeremy and then Victoria on this, because I loved your answer, partly because it partially surprises me, because you, in a good way, I mean, you mentioned a lot of things that have happened since the reset. And by implication, you can tell me if I'm wrong, by implication, it sounded like you saw things like the Georgia crisis of 2008 or Russia's anger at NATO expansion earlier in the decade as less important, or at least maybe at that point balanced by other positive trends that were equally powerful. And it wasn't really until, you know, a certain distance into the Obama years that things really started to head downward. Is that a fair interpretation?
Well, yeah, I guess I would downplay that. I mean, in part, and I don't think this was the Bush administration's view. I think Georgia bore a fair degree of responsibility for the Georgia conflict. I mean, specifically, the fact that war broke out in August 2008, I think, was due to a bad decision by President Saakashvili to try to recapture South Ossetia. I mean, even had the Georgian military been incredibly successful tactically, had they taken Skhinvali, had they broken the Roki Tunnel, I mean, Victoria, you can tell me, my guess is Russia wouldn't have said, oh, you got us, and stopped. So I don't understand that. Now, on the NATO question, I guess, and this may be an area where we can get into more detail a little bit later, I think it was pretty clear from 2008 on from the Bucharest summit that the idea of putting either Ukraine or Georgia on a NATO membership track was going to be really, really hard. I mean, you had Chancellor Merkel, then French President Sarkozy oppose it, and some others. I think it became even more difficult after the Georgia conflict because people in NATO, particularly in Europe, began to understand if you're talking about NATO membership, that prospectively means going to war with Russia. The Obama administration, my guess is that in specifically the Ukraine case, in 2010, when Viktor Yanukovych became president, he made very clear at the beginning that his focus for European integration was going to be the European Union. And he said he didn't want to get any closer. He basically wrote off the idea of pursuing a membership action plan with NATO. And my guess is that, you know, the Obama administration was very comfortable with that, in part because that prevented Ukraine from becoming a difficult issue on the U.S.-Russia agenda when they were still very much focused on reset. So I think the NATO question was pretty much, in real terms, was sort of off the board, although I'm not sure it was in the perception of many in Moscow. But looking, for example, at the Georgia question, again, since the Georgia-Ukraine conflict, my guess is no support for Georgia in NATO. And in general, with regards to Ukraine, no appetite for enlargement. Plus, particularly as the crisis developed in February, March, from the perspective of Ukrainian internal politics, you know, if President Poroshenko wants to try to find a way to bring eastern Ukraine back, the last foreign policy issue he's going to embrace is joining NATO, which is pushes eastern Ukraine away. So I tend to discount the NATO factor, although my guess is that in Moscow it's seen in a very different way.
Thank you. Jeremy, over to you.
Thanks. you know, it's an interesting question. I guess I agree, and I think it's probably important to state at the outset that the sort of the proximate cause, the reason that we're in this current mess in U.S.-Russian relations, is the Russian invasion of Ukraine, of its neighbor, which is, you know, at the worst, a serious violation of international law, and at the best, extremely rude. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind. But as my ex-wife often reminded me, if you have a big argument like that that seems to blow up immediately, there's probably deeper causes going back in time.
See why we have them on panel. So yeah.
That one takes a while to sink in, I know. And I think that that's the case here. And actually, I think you need to go back a lot further than the 2009 reset. I think a lot of it does come back to something that Victoria started off with, which is this very different understandings of Russia's role in the world that followed immediately after the Cold War. The United States very much had the feeling throughout the 1990s that Russia had become a non-factor in international politics, that it was completely unable of asserting its will, of opposing any U.S. government policies. For a while this was true, I think. This was broadly the case in the 1990s. It sort of reminds to capture the American attitude in these days is there's a sort of apocryphal story, probably apocryphal story, of an American economic mission going to Russia, and they kept referring to Russia as a developing country, and the Russians say, you can't say that to us, we are not a developing country. And the American official pauses and says, well, you're right, but you should be. and this was very much the attitude of the Americans. And so all of the policies that were put into place in the 1990s in terms of not just NATO enlargement, but also European Union enlargement, and also the whole democratization push throughout the world, and the sort of notion that, again, that's something that Victoria referred to, that democracy was something that would inevitably come to all countries, including Russia, was seen as something that was quite threatening to the Russians. And it's not surprising, and a lot of people predicted at the time that when the Russians were able to do something about that, they would. And they have. And so I think it's important in this context to see from a Russian perspective, and by the way, Sam Charop and I tried to sort of talk about this in the current issue of Current History, so if you want to read that, it's on the Brookings website. It's brilliant. And I think that what we're getting at is that from the Russian perspective, this, again, not just NATO enlargement, but this entire complex of issues is a policy which is ultimately aimed at Russian regime change. It's ultimately aimed not through military invasion, but through the creation of an international order and through these sort of colored revolutions are aimed at putting into place a Russian regime which is more friendly to the United States, which is more congenial with the U.S.-led world order. And, of course, this is not a crazy conclusion, because if you listen to American rhetoric, it's very much what we have said. We put it in different terms, of course. We say that we want Russia to become a democracy, which from our perspective is a sort of unalloyed good. But of course, if you're part of an autocratic regime in Russia, that is regime change. So it's not surprising to me in that context that when the Ukraine crisis starts and there is the sort of equivalent of another colored revolution in Ukraine, that the Russians see that as yet another in the sort of slow-moving effort to use European institutional enlargement and revolution by demonstration, colored revolutions, to put further pressure on Russia and to sort of advance the borders of the Western sphere of influence. And so they lash out. I think a lot of those, as Steve implied, I think a lot of those interpretations are not precisely correct, but I'm not surprised that they hold them. I think if we saw if we saw a Russian civil society effort to put into place a more Russia-friendly regime in Mexico, we would have a similar response. But nonetheless, I think that I think some of these perceptions are wrong. But nonetheless, they are there. They're not crazy, and they do predict this type of reaction. And so we have a sort of typical security dilemma situation where actions are misinterpreted by the others, and that creates a spiral of conflict. And I think it's something we need to really be very seriously worried about, because although there are ways to de-escalate it, I don't see in the Western response as of now an effort to de-escalate it. You see a little bit of this in Minsk, so I could be wrong. But rather what I see is an effort to double down on the enlargement of the European institutions. The first thing that the United States and Europe did with Ukraine after the revolution there was to sign an association agreement with Europe, which had been the proximate cause of the invasion of Crimea, and to step up the rhetoric about democratization and step up the rhetoric about Putin specifically as an autocrat. And I think if you notice everything that I said, it doesn't actually ascribe a super important role to Putin as an individual. He is a reflection of, in my mind, he is a reflection of what we could expect out of Russia. And although, of course, he's a very important leader, he's a very charismatic leader, and he has a lot of decision-making power in Russia, this is, to my mind, not fundamentally a Putin problem. It's a U.S.-Russian problem. And by focusing on the man of Putin, we've tried to, I think the U.S. has tried to convey the idea that that the democratization concept can still work for Russia if we can just get Putin out of the way. But of course, we've conveyed to the Russians and the Russian regime that we're still interested in regime change by softer means. And I think that that is a recipe for a lot more conflict. And I guess at the end of the day, while I'm not sure about the ranking that President Obama did in that New York speech, I'm actually even more concerned about putting Ebola first. You know, Russia does have quite a few nuclear weapons. Just one of these can ruin your entire day. And I think we need to be very concerned about the degree of conflict that we create with a country that is aggressive, that often misinterprets our actions, that feels threatened and a lot less powerful than we are.
Thank you. And so, Victoria, over to you. And I hope you can feel free to react in part or just explain from first principles your view of the origin of the problems we're now facing in the relationship with the U.S. and Russia.
Mark, actually, this is their case when I would agree to a big extent with a lot of things that Steve and Jeremy have said so far. And probably I will start with their notion that what is the main thing about Russian politics, and it's been long there, it's been true feature of the Soviet policies as well, it's their reactive policies. You said that we respond symmetrically, although our officials like to say, especially when it concerns military cases, asymmetrically, like with ABM, but that's not the point. The point is that it's never coming out with a new idea, with a new initiative. It's always reacting to what we're having, and it's a way to somehow either mend or try to push it away. So the same, I would say, concerns to a huge extent, at least in Russian perception. I don't claim this is 100% true, but this is how it's seen from that side, the other side of the border. So the reset. If you remember, I think it was 2009 in Moscow, and Obama was saying that publicly that, well, Medvedev is a modern leader, and Putin stands with one foot in the history, so he shouldn't be considered. And then when he came to Moscow, obviously, Putin had Obama in Nova Gorova lecturing him for 2 hours. This is not what you can say about their public figures, about the leaders of the country, and how you should behave. So it was a very good start. Next thing I would say, and this was all already based on the ongoing, not conflict, but discord in terms of ABM. I think Steve mentioned that. And Russia was at different times proposing first Gobolinskaya radio station in to use it together. Then there was another suggestion to use ABM in Europe and in Russia jointly, which was rejected. And say, okay, let's exchange information. You trust us, we trust you. I'm like, what are we talking about if there's nothing? Then we had their suggestion, okay, let's do their a legally binding agreement that the ABM is not against us. And this was not agreed here, which is like, I mean, it's a piece of paper after all. I didn't see much sense in this suggestion from the Russian side, but still it was also turned down. It gave a huge advantage in terms of how to influence Russian public opinion in Russia. Okay, you see, they don't even want this piece of paper, which would say that the ABM is not against Russia. So that's one thing. So I started with a personal misunderstanding between Obama and Putin. I do have different versions of why Putin came back to power, and part of it is that he was not going to be back, but following Medvedev's policies, he kind of had to, asked by a number of influential oligarchs. So, but that's a different question. So this was the first thing. Then in 2012, Biden publicly proclaimed again, so it was public, that Putin should not ballot as a candidate for the presidency. And you clearly could see that this is not something you can tell to the country that you see as a sovereign, equal player in the international arena. You can say it to some subordinate state, and still it would be taken, I mean, it's not practice of their diplomatic practice, common diplomatic practice. So it's very humiliating. Then we had this tit for tat during the G8 at that point, and then APEC summits, when Putin didn't come allegedly because of the need to form the new government. And then he sent Medvedev, who was allegedly better on better terms both with Obama and with other leaders. But it was still not number one, right? And he didn't have power to take decisions and to agree upon within the G8. I even remember when he was a president, there was a case when Medvedev said, okay, I think it was on Libya. He said, yes, we totally on the same note with all my other G7 colleagues. And then his statement was disclaimed by foreign ministry even. So he was never really having the full hand on the foreign policy, but when he was sent as a prime minister to that event, so it was a number two, not number one. But, and again, that's how it is seen from Russia, which is extremely psychologically vulnerable, its government, to how things appear, and it's always reciprocal. So number two to Camp David, and then APEC summit, Obama is sending number three. So it's again a kind of a harsher response. It might seem, you know, really childish to view it this way, but I mean, that's how it's seen, and it's a big politics, and that's how it is being influenced. Then I'm very grateful for mentioning Magnitsky Act. There is one thing. There was an ongoing story since 1972, I believe, with the Jackson-Vanik. Russia was striving courageous for it to be abolished, because there was no such conditions any longer as limitations on Jewish residents to go like abroad. So, but Jackson-Vanik was never abolished before the time when Magnitsky Act was adopted. So it had there an idea that, okay, we're not seen as equal, and then now we're having a direct targeting against our officials that have our powerful decisions. Yes, obviously, when you take countermeasures, and it does sound funny, I agree, when you say, okay, so those American officials or European officials cannot go to Russia, but why not spend vacations in Siberia? I bet you'd love it.
So, to ban from that.
No, it's actually very beautiful. But then reaction to Bolotnaya Площадь and Bolotnaya Square, but it's also actually inflamed further Russian government fears that Americans are striving at regime change, because if you support openly Bolotnaya Square protests, that means you're igniting their regime change and color revolution. And besides, they started again this, they had their white ribbons. So it had same implications as in different cases, in previous cases. So Bolotnaya Square. Then Snowden. It was still probably a minor. So it had a huge PR effect, negative PR effect. But I would say Russia was more of a victim in there, because he did fly to Hong Kong first. And Chinese got everything from him they wanted. And then they just put him on the plane. And from what I heard, Putin learned that he's landing in Moscow 2 hours prior to when he landed. And mind it, it's 8-hour flight. So he learned about it after he already left Hong Kong, so he couldn't have known about it. But if you want to have a reaction further on, I mean, there was no way Russia could behave differently. And I mean, if he was allowed to go to some Latin American country freely, they would love to do it. I mean, Putin would have been happy to do that. But if he was to kind of put him on the plane irrespectively, knowing that there is a threat for the guy, and just allowed for him to be captured, that would mean, in their eyes of the rest of the world, not of the Western world, but the rest of the developing world, and Russia, especially after having a deteriorated relations with the West as a whole, started paying more attention to the emerging economies and developing countries. So it would have huge impact on its authority and on its reputation. It would say, okay, you know what? They're like them. They don't care. They are eager to give out the person. So they had to behave the way they did. There was no other exit from the situation. Then next not positive development was when they started a PR campaign around gay, lesbian rights in Russia. Well, when you talk about our parliament and people like Zhirinovsky, you should understand he's not mainstream, right? If you listen to such people like him or Dugin, I mean, you would have similar, let's say, not very adequate people as well. So it's not that you will judge their saying as a governmental policy, right? So I would say this was part of their problem, and that's why it got a higher priority, and it did not have. So now when I would have an American asking, so, like, there was a my university anniversary recently, concert in GIMO, and one of the Americans says, so how many singers? And we had huge amount of very famous ones from Estonia, from Latvia, very famous Russian singer singing in Ukrainian, such an anti-Ukrainian sentiment, right? More, right? And then Belarus, etc. So when he said, so how many of them were openly gay? I'm like, this is not a problem. Russians, it might be kind of taken as a political issue by such people like Zhirinovsky, but I have a number of friends, and when I had people coming from Europe, they say, you know what, we feel there are more gays here, we've met more there, and just like not oppressed, as opposed to, let's say, Poland. So Poland would be more conservative in this regard. So it was more a PR action, but it led to a political decision of not participating in the opening of the Olympic Games. And Russians did count on it as a huge PR effect. It's a soft power, and it was important. It was a very unnice, let's say, development for Putin personally and for the government. So this is just kind of a list of all their, you know, small and in some points bigger steps that led to their further deterioration and the end of their reset policy. And unfortunately, I would say, as in many cases, it does involve personal personal relations between the leaders. So we will need different set of leaders for it to reappear on either side.
Excellent. Okay. We're going to go to you in just a second. Quick follow-up by Steve.
Yeah. No, I want to respond and agree with a couple of points and disagree on one. I mean, first of all, I completely agree on the Snowden case. I think it was not a smart move of the U.S. government to be publicly demanding Snowden's return when we all knew in the reverse situation we would never consider sending a Russian back under the circumstances. Second, I also agree with you on Jackson Vanik. I think Congress has not done itself credit with congressional sanctions. If I were in Moscow, I think the Magnitsky deal would have zero effect because I would say, well, look at Jackson Vanik. When in 1992, 93, we met the requirements, it still took us almost 20 years to get off of it. So I think that was mishandled. On the personal relationships, they can affect the relationship, although I tend... And I agree the personal dynamic between President Obama and President Putin has not been a good one. But I guess I wouldn't overplay it because I would go back to the previous administration where I think there was a very good, very positive dynamic personally between Vladimir Putin and George Bush. Now, I don't know why. I mean, a former KGB officer and a southern American governor, it's not like they have a lot of things in common. But I still believe that if you told George Bush, you've got to go spend 30 days on a desert island with five foreign leaders, Putin might well be among that group. But even when you had that, but even when you had that good chemistry there, it still did not arrest the declining relationship from 2004 really up into the present. The last point I would make is just because it's arms control close to my heart, missile defense. When Russia asked for a legally binding guarantee that American missile defenses would not be directed against Russian strategic forces. But they also said, there should be objective criteria, which were defined basically as limits on numbers, types, and locations. So it was really a resurrection of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Now, I actually think if we were talking about a 10-year treaty, it would have been fairly easy. Several of us could have sat down with Sergei Ryabkov. We could have come up with a 10-year treaty that would have, one, assured Russia that there was no threat to its strategic forces, and two, it would have allowed the United States to do everything it would like to do vis-a-vis North Korea and Iran. And I'm absolutely sure that treaty would have zero chance of being ratified by the Senate. I mean, that's our problem. We unfortunately, I think for some in our Senate, missile defense has become an almost theological issue. And so we're not able to approach this in what might be a more rational way. And while I would say I'm sympathetic to the Russian position that at some point, if you're going to have legally mandated reductions on offensive forces, there should be legal limits on missile defenses. But I would argue that point comes down the road when you have much more equivalence between offense and defense. And now when you're looking at under the New START Treaty in 2018, when the limits kick in, Russia will have 1,500 deployed strategic warheads on ballistic missiles. At that time, the U.S. will have maybe 44 interceptors with the velocity capable to engage those warheads. I think that gap is so large you can look at other ways. And there was an offer made a year ago on a transparency agreement, which I think might suffice now, bearing in mind that if you begin to narrow that gap at some point, legal limits might make sense.
Yes, I would agree with that. But when we talk about the nuclear, right? So first of all, we have different understanding of what is, like how you reduce it. So we talk more about eliminating those weapons. You talk about stockpiling. So that's a difference. And the other thing that, and there is a concern on that front in Russia, in military and political circles, is that, yes, nuclear, although I think it's outdated, but it's still seen, at least in Russia, as a method of containment. But in reality, now America is very far, ahead of Russia, because you have high-precision, hypersonic weapons, which Russia...
We're working on it.
You're working on that. You're close to that. You have a number of very high-tech weapons that Russia do not possess. And that's a concern because, for example, if we go to zero nuclear, then it's clearly plays into the hands of America. At least that's seen. That's how it's seen, being the only dominating military power in the world that would do anything it wants. Right. So this has to be taken into account, and also mind that Russia now spends. It has, as opposed to the Soviet Union, they're different data, but let's take the middle range, the 12% of GDP for defense that was used during the Soviet times. It was still smaller than US one. And now it's, I think it's 4%. And it's much, much smaller than either US or Chinese or even French budget for defense. Yes, it is. It's smaller.
We're also 4%.
No, I mean, but in absolute terms, it's much smaller. So,
but then the U.S. and China, I think you're actually now ahead of the French.
I think we're low. So that's another thing why there might be more concerns on the part of Russia as opposed to United States on this in this area.
I just have one question I'm going to pose to you, and then again go to yours. This is just for Vika. What I think I hear you saying, so I want to summarize very quickly and then pose it as a question, that in the last 25 years, the United States, and Jeremy also built into this narrative, so you can correct me if I'm getting some of it wrong in terms of your thinking, but the United States, in a sense, took advantage of Russian weakness. We all seem to love Yeltsin. For you all, he was a nightmare. He was watching your country practically self-disintegrate. And we were expanding NATO eastward. You didn't talk a lot about that today, actually, but in any event, it was, in some Russian eyes, taking advantage of the way the Cold War ended. And then we didn't, therefore, appreciate the degree to which Putin would appeal simply because Russians needed order and a sense of strength and a sense of proper rights and responsibilities and prerogatives on the world stage, and Yeltsin brought all that. And therefore, given what had come before, the humiliation, the distress about the future, the chaos of the 1990s, it's natural that Russians would, to some extent, appreciate Putin and appreciate the way he was pushing back against the rest of the world. The question I have, though, is even if all that is understandable, don't many Russians still want us to keep standing up for some of these values of free press, democracy, on the theory that Putin himself has a bit of a personal interest in suppressing some of that? And even if you don't always like the way we get involved in Russian internal politics and see that as a sign of our hegemonism and so forth, that Russians still, many Russian reformers, intellectuals, next generation, we've been told over the years that some of you are nervous about Putin, not you personally, I don't want to impose views on you, but that your generation actually would welcome the international community keeping up a little bit of pressure in some ways, maybe not Magnitsky lists, maybe not huge brouhahas at the UN or anywhere else, but a little bit of quieter pressure. And wouldn't that be actually a useful role that we could play?
Okay. So just to refer a bit to Yeltsin, because you mentioned I couldn't go. Well, he still was not such a drunkard as he ended up. When he was asked in the early 90s, if you were in the shoes of Gorbachev, if you, not him, but you managed to get to the ladder as a president of the Soviet Union, would you ever allow it to disintegrate? He said never. So, I mean, everybody, many people here view him as a big liberal, outgoing and very positive figure. But he managed, I mean, he happened to be in their lower ladder, like at the lower level, of, at the ladder of power. And so he just got his chair. But if he managed, if he were in the shoes of Gorbachev, he would have tried to have Soviet Union as a remaining power. So as far as your question goes, the problem is that, first of all, you should, if you do aspire for democracy, you should understand. But here I would say there is a game of two things, like several factors. One is real pressure that comes from you, but the other one is a PR campaign that is held on the internal stage, which leads to people believing, you know, in evil empire from the United States is an evil empire. But you should remember that 80% of population do support him. I mean, this might be different with regards not to the younger generation, but more to Moscow and St. Petersburg, for example, because it's, I would say, we're less Russia than anything. But even if you take, if you talk about majority of intellectuals, the problem is that America has gained this reputation, as well as some other countries, in the so-called West, I don't like this word, gain the reputation that you do not really care about the rights of the people, because it's actually with the ongoing crisis, they came more suppression as opposed to earlier days, and there was no reason to introduce that, so they wouldn't be able to motivate it anyhow. So that it's not about the rights of the Russians, but more about geopolitical interests that America is trying to achieve via defending the rights of Russians.
We don't have credibility, and
that's
therefore we
the
should
thing.
Just...
And unfortunately, I've been working with their civil society groups back when we had their still G8 presidency in 2006. And my group also included the human rights activists. And what I noticed, that the ones that were closest to the, let's say, Western values, they would claim that they would defend Russian rights in the regions, elsewhere, but then they would have a site only in English. So they would get grants from you, like from America, for example, but then the activities they were holding were not directed to improve the well-being of the common people, but rather to show how they do something to the United States, which didn't give credibility to them among the people. So that's why it's probably became more a lost case as opposed to United States being seen as a good power. Because I would compare it a bit to Canadians were a bit skilled in that, because they were not investing that much into political projects, but rather social projects, which didn't introduce conditionality. So, but United States, as a leader in that, is seen as mostly not credible and promoting its geopolitical interests.
Jeremy, quick question, and then I'm looking to the crowd.
I'm surprised you fell for that Canadian sham, but okay. I think that I guess I basically agree. So let me just sort of reemphasize from my perspective, what Victoria was just saying. I think that there is a desire among at least some parts of the population in Russia for democracy and human rights. This is what people want this everywhere, after all. And there is a fear of, and we saw this in the protests over the election. There is a fear of Putin's
autocracy. That definitely exists. But I think worse than the idea that the U.S. doesn't have credibility for this, the U.S. actually plays into Putin's hands by promoting this stuff. Because what Putin has been able to do, what the current Russian regime has been able to do, is associate the United States with the democratization movement and associate it with these geopolitical motives that were just alluded to, the democratization movement in Russia. And I think, although many Russians, I think, could be Democrats, many Russians are interested in human rights, many more of them, and all of them, frankly, are first and foremost Russian nationalists, Russian sovereigntists. That's come out very clearly here. I remember very clearly going to Russia not too long after the Kosovo War, and one of the most liberal politicians in Russia saying to me that he understood very well that if Russia didn't have nuclear weapons, the bombs would have been falling on Moscow as well as on Belgrade.
It's very spread.
This was a sentiment across the Russian political spectrum, because the sense was that it was the United States' efforts at democratization had a geopolitical motive and were aimed against Russian sovereignty. And so even the people who supported it were a bit wary of the messenger. And I think Putin has played on that very, very effectively. And he's actually, that's the reason why he's imputed democratization strategies where they don't even exist. But there are enough that there's an important grain of truth to it. And so I think that we have to be careful to not consider ourselves some sort of exogenous benign force, and to understand that people will see not only the message, but the messenger.
Well, I've lost all my credibility with you because I promised to bring you in about a half hour ago, but I've been having too much fun up here with these folks. So let's finally get to you folks, and let's go three questions at a time, see if we can get a couple of rounds in before we have to finish. So I'll start here with these three. First, this woman right here, and then gentlemen, and then over here to the side.
Thank you very much. I just wonder if you can give us some kind of description about social cultural values in Russia and America. And the way I'm thinking is that you may think that democracy in America is nothing at all, it's fake. And then, but maybe you like to say maybe communist is good and America is against communist. And this has happened for decades. Maybe you can make some comparison when you are little and young and you are educated in Russia and in the United States. Could you give us some comparison how you grow up and how they change your thinking and value?
Thank you. This gentleman here.
Hi, Will Sachin from Plowshares Fund. First of all, very good talk. A lot of interesting points. I think my employers would be very upset if I didn't ask a little bit about the nuclear issue. I think we've all gotten a very bleak picture of the relationship, as it's bad, but it isn't broken. What do you, Mr. Pfeiffer specifically, what do you see as the odds of continuing work on nuclear reductions, let's say in the next 5-10 years, of seeing another start?
Finally, over here.
Nick Farmer, can you speak to energy policy on both sides and whether that's a potential source of either cooperation or conflict, thinking about the importance of oil and gas exports to Russia, the U.S. and European Union emphasis on climate change and reducing dependence on oil and gas, the impact that reduced oil prices had on the Soviet Union and the contribution made to its collapse? How might that affect relationships going forward in the next 10 years?
I guess the first one was for you, and the last one if you wish, and then the second one for you, and then Jeremy can comment if he wishes at the end. So, Vika, you'd like to start?
Sure. So in terms of how my values changed, I'm very grateful to America for making me more outspoken, believing more in myself, although I was coming here, and we had this huge view of America in mid-90s as a very democratic power. It's a land of opportunity, a land of total freedom. To some extent, I mean, it really helped to be to go ahead. On the other hand, I learned, well, you know what? It's not totally free, probably. And in some cases, Russia is less rule embraced as opposed to America. We in some cases have more freedoms. So, but my education in both countries allowed for me to try to take extremely patriotic, but probably more or less balanced position. And even if I see and would think that America, like American government, not America, is doing something I would disagree with, or which goes against the line of my country, I can still explain it to myself and say, well, how would we behave, for example? And I used to say, well, if it was the Soviet Union that remained as opposed to America, it might have been a bigger disaster in terms of having a unipolar world. So I would say it helped me to be more open to different views and accepting those different views. In terms of energy policy, I would say we had a bigger opportunity for cooperative energy relations earlier when we had the opening of the American-Russia energy dialogue, which unfortunately didn't go further. Some of it, like misunderstanding or let's say misperception of what's important for Russian national interests, what's important for American national interests, and a lot of it is not being in the demand of politics, but being in the demand of, unfortunately, national policies being identified, or vice versa, commercial interests of certain companies and persons being identified, like Gazprom and others involved in that, as national interests, which is totally not how it should be. So this is part of the reason why dialogue didn't go further, I would say. But it's not one-sided. So the other one is that conditionality and probably trying to use Russian resources, like on American side, as it was used during the Red Line Agreement, right, in the Middle East. So not to the same extent, but Russia perceived that probably Americans would, as well as the Europeans and other or transnational companies, would approach it and its energy resources as just to make use of it, but without giving extra credit to the country. So that's why I think energy policy didn't go. There is a huge potential for the conflict. Unfortunately, this area is highly politicized, which should not be the case. Our biggest problem that if we talk about energy, we talk about commercial deals. So if somebody, I'm sorry, this might sound tough, but I guess you should understand me here as a land of capitalism. If somebody cannot pay for something, this somebody is not supposed to steal it or to say, you know, we're so nice, like not to you, to others, but you still have to give it to us for free because we're so nice. So this is not how it should go. You can pay for it. The price that goes, the price that is set by, I don't know, market mechanisms, whatever, you pay for it, you get it. If you cannot, you ask somebody, either you return with some kind of something else with political loyalty, you ask money from somebody else to whom you give this political loyalty. So, but here it seems to be a street with a one, let's say, going one direction. So yes, you are the country with the resources. For some reason, they have to be of general public use, and you have to give it. So this is the often their approach that Russia is having. Although, as I say, I strongly disagree and disapprove of Gazprom policies, and I think that our interests kind of they are being changed from one to the other, and this is not national interests. So this is about politicizing the issue. As far as climate change goes, I think it's more relevant for global arena, as
as opposed to Russia-America relations, and I think we have a much closer understanding of the issue, and it's a potential area of cooperation as opposed to, let's say, even emerging economies. So this is an area where Russia is much closer to its Western colleagues, even though Russia and Europe are different there. United States and Europe are different than there, and Russia has still some aspects. But we're much closer and have more potential for cooperation in this area as opposed to the other side of the
world. Steve, why don't you do the arms control? And Jeremy, if you don't mind, I'll promise you the first chance to respond to the next round, and then we'll see if we can fit one more in.
Just very quick on the energy question, because I think you were alluding to Ukraine, Russia, when you were talking about paying, getting something. But I actually think that you would find that there's a lot of sympathy in the U.S. government and the United States for that point of view. In fact, probably more so than in Europe. In Europe, for example, in the 2009 gas crisis, there was some saying, how can you possibly do this when it's a cold winter? But the question gets more on, is it a reasonable price, that sort of thing. On the arms control question, I guess the optimist in me says that I can see a U.S.-Russia arms control negotiation definitely around 2019, because I think at the end of the day, while Russia, I don't believe now, is prepared for further reductions, I think the Russians, like the United States, appreciate that New START provides a cap on overall strategic weapons levels. It provides predictability, transparency. So 2019, when you're 2 years out from the New START treaty's expiration, I think the Russians will want to do that. Now the question is, and I'm less optimistic about, could you do something before that would be more dramatic in terms of reductions? And there I think it's hard to say. I mean, 2 years ago, Mike and I wrote a book called The Opportunity, where we had some grand ideas. Clearly not enough people read the book. What we argued for at the time was we thought that the United States and Russia could make about a 50% reduction, and not just in deployed strategic weapons, but also in reserve strategic weapons and tactical weapons, basically cut their overall arsenals down to about 2,000 to 2,500 each. And at that point, then it might make sense to bring in third countries. But as far as I can tell, I mean, again, what I've heard from the Obama administration over the last 4 or 5 years, they would like to get into that approach. Already in 2010, President Obama, in fact, the day he signed the New START Treaty, said, let's now reduce this number and bring in the other weapons. But there hasn't been a readiness on the part of the Russian side to do that. And what the Russians have done is they said, well, it's linked to issues like missile defense, prompt global strike, things like that. And I actually think if you took each one of those issues separately, you could resolve them in a way. But I haven't seen a readiness on the Russian side to resolve those questions. So my assessment, which may be wrong, is that the Russians have drawn those linkages because at this point in time, they're not prepared to go to further nuclear reductions.
Be very quick. I would say Russia would not go further unless all five countries at least are involved. That's for sure. That's very clear, and that's very essential.
And certainly, Foreign Minister Lavrov said that. Again, I think that that's a position that may make sense down the road. I'm not sure it's necessary now.
Okay, so we're into the lightning round. Three more quick questions. Actually, four, because I'm going to add one first. And then we'll go to Jeremy, Steve, and then Vika to finish. Vika, this question is for you. We've sometimes heard Vladimir Putin and others talk about a right to or a need to protect ethnic Russians wherever they may be. In this earlier conversation about whether we're back towards in the direction of the Cold War or not, how does the danger rank? The one thing that would make me really nervous is if Vladimir Putin felt the opportunity, the right, the contrived need to defend ethnic Russians in the Baltic states, because then we're talking about Russia versus NATO Article 5.
To say nothing of Brighton Beach.
Please tell me if that's something I have to worry about. And from the point of view of Vladimir Putin specifically or Russia in general. So a Baltic State Article 5 question. But now let's take three. One, Jason, and then three here, and we'll be done.
I'm Basil Skarlis. I would like to ask Professor Panova, is there any hope of U.S.-Russian cooperation in the field of cybercrime? The impression of some in the United States is Russian cyber criminals are tolerated in Russia and attack freely the American banking system.
Yeah, to Jason.
Hi, Jason Tama here at Brookings. I wanted to ask Victoria, you kind of articulated a list of grievances about, from the Russian perspective, of not being a global player, being marginalized. Do Russians feel now they're better off in that respect after where we are with Ukraine? Thank you.
Right here, it's here.
Hi, this is William Beaver from Africa Worldwide. I have a question about NATO's role in keeping Russia from any more aggression in Eastern Europe and what sort of role they can play, whether or not NATO buildup in Baltic states, for example, might be helpful from the U.S.'s perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. So most of the questions were for Vika, but we'll start with Jeremy, then Steve, and then Vika to finish.
Yeah, I don't want you guys to know I didn't take that personally at all. let me just touch on this this energy issue. In the typology that I sort of drew, energy is mostly a regional issue. Climate change, I guess, is global, but energy is regional. I think it's a very difficult place for the U.S. and Russia to cooperate, particularly because both sides have for a long time accepted, going well back into the 90s, that energy is fundamentally a geopolitical rather than a commercial issue. And both sides have been operating that way for a long time. I think the idea of sort of trying to have even a discussion about, well, this is actual pure commercial practice or this is pure commercial practice is kind of ridiculous on both sides, frankly. There is nothing resembling pure commercial practice in the European, in the European-Russian gas interaction, and I don't think we're going to get anywhere close to that in a long time. So it's all geopolitical, and I think it makes their cooperation very difficult. I think that also we have to be a little bit concerned about the effect of energy prices on the Russians, and this is frustrating because we have to be concerned no matter which direction it goes. My colleague Cliff Gaddy a number of years ago did a very interesting project sort of correlating Russian behavior and energy prices. And you see that actually Russia becomes much more aggressive when energy prices goes up and becomes much more and suffers enormous damage when energy prices go down. And so this is something that dates back essentially since the end of the Second World War. And I think the Russian state has continually failed to diversify or to lead a diversification of the economy, which renders them still not quite as vulnerable as they were 10 years ago to this, but still quite vulnerable. And I really don't want to understand what a Russia that feels like it's slipping in the global tables will do right now. In terms of the question about what NATO can do in the Baltics, look, this is a difficult question for me, at least. I think that we have had, and I laid out a history of not just NATO enlargement, but general European enlargement, institutional enlargement, as being something that the Russians view as very threatening and something that has pushed them into a lot of the policies that we've talked about today. But nonetheless, NATO enlargement has happened, and I think from a strictly U.S. perspective, we have a strong interest in making sure that Article 5 is something that we that has life, that means something. I guess I would prefer, if I was doing history over again, not to have pushed Article 5 all the way to the Estonian border with Russia, but we have. And so I think it makes sense to signal to the Russians that that Article 5 is a very different thing for the United States than struggles in Ukraine and struggles in Georgia. And that at the same time that we aren't determined to push Article 5 everywhere, that where it is, it makes a difference. Because I don't think we want to get into the situation that I think Mike was alluding to, where we have Russians testing the credibility of Article 5 and finding ourselves either forced to respond in a way which would be very escalatory, or forced to back down in a way which would gut the Article 5 commitment that I think we found very useful over the years.
Steve, any final thoughts?
Yeah, let me take the NATO question and NATO-Russia. And I think Jeremy's right that there's a perception in Moscow about NATO taking advantage of Russian weakness, but I actually think that narrative is flawed. I mean,
why is it important whether the narrative is flawed?
Well, yeah, no, okay, that's a fair point. But I mean, I think going back, and if you look at, I think, fairly, particularly President Clinton, in an engagement with Boris Yeltsin, making efforts to try to build a NATO-Russia relationship. Now, I think we were we made our mistake was we underestimated how much antipathy there was in Moscow towards the idea of NATO and NATO enlargement, and we overestimated our ability to build this NATO-Russia relationship that would be so cooperative and positive that the Russians would not care about NATO enlargement. But there were also the commitments made there in 1997 about no permanent station of substantial combat forces on the territory of new members of NATO. And that really applied from 97 up until February, March, April of this year, when I think you have seen in NATO that something has changed in Russia, and it followed the Russians' illegal occupation of Crimea and then military activities in eastern Ukraine. And you now have a point where I think NATO sees in a way that it didn't see 15 years ago or 10 years ago or perhaps even 1 or 2 years, a requirement to have some sort of military capability that doesn't necessarily have to be large, but there should be military capabilities basically to reassure the Baltic states and Central Europeans, but also to make sure that there's a very clear red line in the mind of the Kremlin that there are defense commitments to NATO. And I think what the U.S. has done, there are now 4 airborne companies deployed in each of the Baltic states and in Poland, 150 troops, light infantry. They don't have significant offensive capability, but they still are there, I think, as a very significant signal of American and NATO commitment to the defense of those countries. And so I think this is something that's changed from a year ago. A year ago, nobody would ever consider this. But my guess is that for the foreseeable future, you are going to see a stronger NATO military presence, not just land forces, but also air forces and maybe naval forces in Central Europe and the Baltic states, because there now is this concern in NATO that with Russia's use of military force against Ukraine, is there a possibility that it might be used elsewhere? And this gets back to your point, Mike, about, you know, the question about the Baltic states.
Thank you. My friend.
So before going to NATO, let's first talk about Russian approach to, yes, you might be very concerned about this protecting ethnic Russians all over the world. But I mean, let's say Russians are also concerned about extraterritorial use of internal law of the United States, which concerns some of the Russians. Right?
We consider all 7 billion people to be fair game
exactly,
for us to protect.
Exactly, exactly. So this could be seen as more scary.
But you can't have 2 countries like that.
Exactly, that's the biggest problem, I guess. So with the Baltics. So Russian minorities problem was high on the agenda earlier in the 90s. And if Russia was wanted to do anything about it militarily or with any other means of hard power, it would have done it back then. It's still possessed of relevant military capability. And I can tell you that I met some Russian speaking people from there who came to America but said, you know what, if only Russia says we'll go back and fight against local governments because they kind of oppress Russians. But this was not the intention, so he didn't want it. That's why nothing happened. And Russia actually, in understanding of Russian politicians, the Baltics were gone outside the post-Soviet space. So it's not the case. There can be pressure, economic pressure, but it was used more earlier with the Sprouts and this gas pipeline interruption, etc., earlier, and with the building of different ports. But there's no way military means are used in the Baltics. Never been such intention. So I would say Baltics are safe. The problem is that there is a lacking soft power and lacking PR, while there is a huge demonstration of hard power elsewhere by Russia, which makes them scared of such a scenario, which is not plausible and not possible at all. So that's the thing. With the Article 5, I would say probably it would be much better and it would allow to ease tensions if it is less emphasized, if Article 5 is emphasized less, and if there is a suggestions coming from NATO to
to elaborate further, to develop their cooperation between NATO and Russia, notwithstanding current crisis, because you have to understand there is a specifics about Russian psychology. The more you push, the more harsher response you get. So if there is a complacency coming about, Russians will be more, and it's on all levels, not just government, but population, especially when now we have not really good economic situation, it's even higher as a priority to kind of explain it somehow. So the population, the government would feel they would need to push back much stronger if there is a harsh rhetoric and like things like, yes, Wales summit, it's not big deal. I mean, it's not a huge offensive force. But, I mean, it was seen as another step in their aggressive direction from NATO's side. Although analysts mostly said, okay, that's not a big deal. No Sweden, no Finland, as they wanted to, then very small reactions. Rapid reaction forces, etc. But still, I mean, there has to be room for maneuver and for soft rhetoric on the other side. With cybercrime, some of it, I mean, most of it, we're not China. We don't have a state-sponsored cyber criminals. So there is a way, I would say our government or our people would suffer from this as well. It probably comes from the fact that we lacked well-elaborated legal system to counter the problem. And so it's now it's being developed, but it's still in the making, I would say. We still need more things to take. But there is a way for tackling the issue. So Russians, do they feel better when they are in confrontation? I would say at least if you go mostly to province, as I said, Moscow, St. Petersburg are different, they do feel proud that Russia managed to push back. And that's why they like Putin, even though they should have been kind of very should have been concerned about economic social situation, which will be getting worse. And I would say it's not just about sanctions; it's deeper. But sometimes, you know, psychological comfort, at least for some period of time, can take place of bread, essential bread for Russians. For NATO's, yes, and I think I responded on the NATO's role in keeping Russians' aggression, as you said. Although, if we talk about aggression, we have, I think we have military people here, or former military, at least. Is there war, current, modern war, possible at all without air without airstrikes and air support today? Is it possible? No. So, response from the military. Would you deem it possible to have Americans go into war without air support, your air force? No?
We do it all the time, sure.
No. If you do it, will you do it without air force support at all? Would you feel it depends rational?
It depends on the scenario.
Depends on the nature of the operation, but it's possible.
It's a suicide.
The U.S. military view is to make the fight as unfair as possible, and if air support is necessary for that,
it's a suicide. Totally. I mean, in current conditions, it will be no country would do it. And now tell me, if you had any reports of the Russian air force planes being over Ukraine.
I've had some reports of that.
No,
yes.
There was none. No air, Russian air force was there. So I don't know what you're talking about.
Somebody beat the Ukrainian army in August and September.
I'm not in government. I'm not a military. I don't know what's actually going on, but I'm just appealing to the logic. But that said,
forces in Crimea, are they Russian? Putin said they were Russian.
By the way, those were under legal arrangements with their Russian fleet. So those were the ones.
The little green men?
Yes, there was an agreement on the Baltic, but on the Black Sea.
Don't say the Baltics, please.
No. But that said, I think this is not used much in American rhetorics, in political lexicon. You have them, I think you, as when you appealed to you when you were talking about Crimea, you would say not Russian, not only Russian military, but green people, right? Would you have that? But the Russians would have a mostly spread term for their Russian military as the most, like, very polite people. So that's a term for the Russian military in Crimea.
And I won't disagree. I
mean,
we have another hour or two here, but I wouldn't disagree that, I mean, there were certain agreements which allowed a Russian military presence in Crimea. Yeah. But those agreements did not allow the Russian military to seize and occupy Crimea.
There was a referendum, which was not the case for Kosovo, unlike your president said, though. He said there was a referendum there. But, well, that's a different point.
Sequence is important. The referendum was after they seized Crimea.
This is great. From my point of view, this is great because you can see we're going to have another event like this sometime next year. And there's still plenty to be for all of us to be feisty about, but we've also had a lot of very penetrating and very thoughtful and helpful analysis. So I want to thank all of you for being here. I'm going to give Vika one last word here in a second, but actually, we're going to have a big round of applause to thank you for coming. So first, your last word.
No, because I was, I didn't finish. When I was talking about it had a reason why I started mentioning polite people. So there is a term for Russian military in Crimea as polite people. It's a coined term. It's everybody when you say that. Some people use it patriotically, some joke about it, but just to prove that we all have sense of humor and that we understand that politics is about games, I would like to give all of you this T-shirt, which says, uh-oh, Putin is the most polite person. That's for you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Jeremy and Steve, and especially Victoria.